Welcome to the Shortwave Report for July 27, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, The Voice of Russia, Radio Havana Cuba, and NHK World Radio Japan. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The European Commission is amending its laws on insider trading, making it a criminal offense to rig interest rates. Paul Watson of Greenpeace has skipped bail in Germany, where he was awaiting extradition to Costa Rica for interrupting a boat catching sharks 10 years ago. Russia has passed a new law to clamp down on non-governmental organizations. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The European Commission has announced that it is amending its proposed new laws on insider trading and market manipulation to make it a criminal offence to rig interbank interest rates. British bank Barclays was fined €369 million last month after admitting it had sought to rig the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, in the UK and its Eurozone equivalent Euribor by submitting incorrect information. Several major moneylenders, including Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase, are also being investigated by regulatory authorities. Canadian marine conservationist Paul Watson has skipped bail and is no longer in Germany, where he had been awaiting possible extradition to Costa Rica. A court in Frankfurt confirmed on Wednesday that Watson had called his lawyer to say he had left Germany for an unknown destination. The case goes back to an incident involving a Costa Rican boat catching sharks at sea in 2002. Costa Rica alleges that Watson, who says he is innocent, interfered illegally with the vessel. Watson was arrested at Frankfurt Airport in May. Costa Rican President Laura Chinchilla visited Berlin and promised Watson a fair trial. In June, Watson met with Baywatch star Pamela Anderson in Frankfurt. His bail had been posted at €250,000.
Russia's parliament has passed a new law to clamp down on non-governmental organizations who receive foreign funding, one which will brand them as foreign agents. This week, the upper house passed the controversial bill overwhelmingly, even after it was criticized around the globe by watchdogs and human rights campaigners. Under the law, Russia will be able to suspend the activities of any foreign agent organization without a court order, and any failure to comply could mean a 3-year prison sentence. I asked Amnesty International's Russia researcher, Denis Krivoshev, what the new law will mean for NGOs in Russia.
For those NGOs which are affected by the law, this will mean a lot. This means, well, first of all, having to refer to themselves as, quote, organizations performing functions of a foreign agent, which sounds really awful in Russian, and I imagine this is the intention of the authors of the law. This sounds as if they were some sort of spies doing some harmful work on behalf of some foreign forces. But this also will involve a lot more administrative hassle. They will have to do more reporting. There are serious fines and even criminal responsibility for failing to comply with the law, compulsory audit, and the authorities will have increased powers to conduct sort of ad hoc checks on these organizations. So it means a lot, and it makes life of NGOs in Russia a lot more complicated.
Who do you see the law as targeted at?
Well, we've been seeing a lot of civic activism in the recent years, and a lot more of it, particularly after the parliamentary and presidential elections at the end of last year, beginning of this one. The authorities clearly were concerned about a lot of criticism they were receiving. And I imagine this law is directed against those who cause a lot of inconvenience to the authorities. These NGOs, the NGOs which were in some way involved in criticism, in, you know, expressing dissenting voices, have been harassed already. We've seen various smear campaigns on the national television. We've seen which targeted both organizations and their leaders. I imagine we'll be seeing a lot more of this, and they seem to be the primary targets. And these are NGOs which work on issues such as corruption, electoral monitoring, environmental issues, and certainly human rights.
Do you think that they will be able to do their work in Russia after the law is passed?
Well, the law does not prohibit work as such, so I'm sure they will. The question is how well they will be able to do it and how difficult it will be from that point. Clearly, there are two elements. One is this will probably mean reduced funding because, unfortunately, this is a fact of life. A lot of work by NGOs in Russia has to rely on foreign funding. Secondly, a lot more admin, diverting valuable resources to reporting and auditing and such things. And finally, and this is the crucial element, this law seems to have the intention to, you know, delegitimize their work. And this is really important. There are some who already are thinking they would rather stop working than be branded foreign agents.
What can these NGOs do about this? Could they reject Russia's demands, or could they turn down the funding so that they wouldn't have to register themselves as foreign agents?
I imagine you can. I mean, there's nothing stopping you from turning down this funding, and if you're not in receipt of any foreign funding, then, yeah, by all means, you do work as before. The trouble is, again, a lot of NGOs, small and big, rely on foreign funding, so I'm not sure how many will be able to afford to do so, and probably not many. Internal sort of national resources sources for funding are very sparse, and they're particularly sparse for those who work who do sensitive work on, you know, on human rights, on corruption and such things. This will be increasingly difficult. But, you know, if you can find other sources, I imagine you can continue working. But again, this will this doesn't apply to many. Many will find it very, very difficult not to have to rely on foreign funding. Therefore, you either follow the law and its rules, or you stop working.
The law has been rushed through Parliament before the summer break in Russia. Now, that's presumably an indication of how important this law is to Putin?
Yes. It's amazing. Within a week, it was approved by Parliament in three hearings, and it's not just that. It's the fact that there was virtually no discussion. It was announced and on very short notice submitted to the Parliament for approval. So last week, it was approved in the lower chamber. As of today, it's fully approved in the Parliament. The upper chamber has now also given its green light to this law. So now it only remains to be signed by the president. And within the period, it indicates, I think it's 120 days, it will come into force.
I remember that during President Putin's campaign, he promised to promote modernization and transparency if elected for another term. What can we expect in Russia now after the passing of this new law?
Well, I can't remember that quote exactly, but I imagine it would be difficult to expect that this kind of legislative initiative and others that we have seen, such as new laws on governing street protest, making them increasingly difficult. The package of this law seems to be intended precisely to make things less transparent and make it increasingly difficult for those who are critical of the government and its policies to freely express their views.
Amnesty International's Russia researcher Denis Krivoshev there, speaking from London.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. Next, the voice of Russia. The United Nations has been discussing the use of U.S. drones in Somalia, where they are interfering with air traffic and violating an arms embargo. A review of the ever-expanding U.S. use of drones in countries around the world. The Voice of Russia.
According to the recent United Nations report, the skies over Somalia have become so congested with unmanned aircraft that this war-torn country faces a real threat to its air traffic security. The drones can also potentially violate a long-standing arms embargo against Somalia. UN officials described several narrowly averted disasters when drones crashed into a refugee camp, flew dangerously close to a fuel pump, and almost collided with a large passenger plane over the Somali capital of Mogadishu.
The UN did not directly blame the United States for the accidents. However, the report noted that at least two of the aircraft appeared to be US-made. Moreover, there seems to be a shroud of mystery around U.S. drone operations in Somalia. Although the U.S. drone missions in Somalia, as well as in Yemen, Afghanistan and Pakistan, have long become routine, it was only last month that the Obama administration acknowledged for the first time that it used drones in a robust range of operations to target al-Qaeda and associated forces.
In Somalia, the target of the unmanned aircraft seems to be the Al-Shabaab, a group of Islamist fighters that controls much of the country and is affiliated with Al-Qaeda. The U.S. Air Force invested millions of dollars to upgrade an airfield in Arba Minch in neighboring Ethiopia, which now houses a fleet of drones that can be equipped with Hellfire missiles and satellite-guided bombs. A similar base was also opened by the U.S. military in the Seychelles, an Indian Ocean archipelago off the Somalian coast. These two bases now complement a much bigger U.S. drone military base in Djibouti, which also borders Somalia.
Wanting to avoid the 1993 Black Hawk Down disaster, in which two U.S. military helicopters were shot down in Mogadishu and 18 American killed, the Obama administration had tried to avoid deploying troops to Somalia. In recent years, however, small teams of CIA operatives and U.S. special forces have gradually stepped up secret missions inside the country to rescue hostages and hunt down al-Shabaab leaders.
The UN Security Council imposed an arms embargo in Somalia in 1992, although it has carved out an exception for an African Union military force that has been battling al-Shabaab and propping up a transitional Somali government based in Mogadishu. The UN Monitoring Group in Somalia, which prepared the new report, said that it considered the use of drones in that country a potential violation of the arms embargo, which it imposed in 1992, since the U.S. aircraft were exclusively military in nature.
Matthew Bryden, a Canadian official and coordinator for the UN Monitoring Group, said that the unmanned military aircraft, such as Predator and Reaper, which U.S. military flies at high altitudes, would be operating in violation of the embargo.
A recent survey conducted by Pew Global Attitudes found that the United States was a significant outlier in an opinion survey about drone use, with 62% of Americans approving the use of drones abroad. In no other country surveyed was there a majority that approved of drone strikes. The UK came closest with an approval rating of 43%. In Spain and Japan, it was only 21%, in Turkey 9%, and in Greece just 5%.
However, the active use of drones by the US military around the world has recently raised concerns even inside the United States. There are currently 64 known drone bases in the US, as well as about 300 different agencies, research organizations, and law enforcement agencies that have a license to use them. Human rights organizations such as Amnesty International fear that the military intelligence drones could be deployed within the US in surveillance missions against American citizens, despite the fact that such use is prohibited by US law.
The lawmakers in the US have also started to look more critically at the program. Last month, 26 House representatives, including Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul, John Conyers, and Michael Konda, wrote a bipartisan letter to the White House expressing concern about the use of signature strikes and the legal basis under which they are conducted, telling the president, "The use of such signature strikes could raise the risk of killing innocent civilians or individuals who may have no relationship to attacks on the United States."
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 11 at 15425-9800 and 9665, or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Homeland Security has announced a new drone squadron for surveillance of the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico. At least 11 people died in a U.S. drone attack last weekend in Pakistan, bringing the total to over 200 dead from such attacks in Pakistan this year. The student movement and teachers' union in Chile have called for a new series of demonstrations to demand free public education. Large demonstrations have continued in Mexico over the results of the presidential election. Russia says that it has not received proposals from the Arab League regarding a power transition plan for Syria. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security announced the setting up of a drone squadron for surveillance activity over the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico under the pretext of fighting drug trafficking. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, already approved the air routes for the spy drones, known worldwide for their raids over Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, as part of the U.S. occupation wars in those nations, Prensa Latina's agency reported. According to the FAA plan, a 2,000-kilometer area will be covered by the drones, which includes the Bahamas, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Puerto Rico, and other Caribbean islands. The first drone base in charge of Caribbean operations will be located in Corpus Christi, Texas, and a second facility will be set up in Cocoa Beach, Florida, according to sources with the U.S. Defense Department. The drones picked for Caribbean surveillance operations include the Predator B, currently being used by the CIA in Afghanistan and Yemen under the official pretext of locating Al-Qaeda groups and other Islamic extremists. Over the past 5 years, Washington has maintained surveillance operations over the Caribbean with Global Hawk spy aircrafts. The U.S. intelligence air operations were carried out over the years, first with U-2 planes and later by SR-71 aircrafts.
At least 11 people were killed in an attack launched by a U.S. drone in the northwestern Pakistani tribal zone, this according to official sources. The raid took place on the district of Chawal, a border zone with Afghanistan, which has been the scenario for frequent U.S. drone attacks. These attacks have claimed over 200 lives in Pakistan this year. In these air operations allegedly aimed against extremist groups, though they oftentimes end up killing the civilian population, human rights groups said, quoted by Russia Today. Pakistani authorities have strongly criticized the drone attacks for considering them a violation of national sovereignty.
The student movement and teachers' union in Chile have called for a new series of demonstrations to demand a free public education system. Participants at a National Assembly of the Teachers' Association held over the weekend called for a national strike on August the 28th, which will stress the need for universal teaching syllabus as a contribution to the quality of education. But the teachers' union has planned other activities. On August the 10th, they will present a document containing proposals agreed on in 700 schools to national and regional education authorities. They will then join a demonstration on August the 14th to protest against a government decree that seeks to amend working conditions of the sector. Meanwhile, the Confederation of Chilean Students said it is planning activities in several universities on August the 4th to honor Manuel Gutierrez, the teenager who was shot dead by a police officer during a demonstration last year. The Confederation, which brings together about 30 university student federations, said it will also join a national mobilization August the 8th, organized by the high school students. Thousands of demonstrators marched through Mexico City on Sunday to protest the outcome of the July 1st general elections, which declared Institutional Revolutionary Party presidential candidate Enrique Peña Nieto the winner. Organized by Mexico's Yo Soy 132 student movement, the anti-Peña Nieto rally began with protesters gathering outside Los Pinos, the official residence and house of the Mexican president. The demonstrators then marched along the city's main avenue, Paseo de la Reforma, to the main square. The demonstrators rejected what they called the imposition of Peña Nieto as president, saying that both right-wing and leftist parties have accused the once-ruling PRI of winning the elections through voter buy-in and fraud. According to the Federal Electoral Institute, which organized the elections and tallied the results, Peña Nieto won with 38.21% of the little more than 50 million votes cast. Runner-up Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the left-leaning progressive movement led by the Democratic Revolution Party garnered 31.59% and Josefina Vázquez-Mota of the ruling Conservative National Action Party obtained 25.41%. Organizers said some 10,000 people marched through the capital, including students, members of Mexico's Electricity Workers Union, the National Teachers Union, among other interest groups. Some protesters carried banners and placards that read, "No to the imposition, IFE equals fraud, and death to Televisa." Opponents claim the nation's main television broadcaster skewed coverage in favor of Peña Nieto. Protesters also carried messages criticizing the nation's electoral tribunal, which has until September the 6th to rule on the validity of the elections and Peña Nieto's victory. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Wednesday that Moscow has not received any official proposals directly from the Arab League regarding a power transition plan for Syria. He acknowledged that he got information via media that Qatari Foreign Minister Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim Al Thani and Arab League Deputy Secretary General Ahmed Ben Heli planned to visit Moscow to present a Syrian transition plan. In this regard, the head of Russian diplomacy said, "If they consider it more useful to speak about that publicly, but not addressing the country they are going to visit, let's wait and see." According to the proposals published by some media, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's resignation was a precondition for transition talks in the country. Speaking at an Arab League meeting on Sunday in Doha, the Qatari foreign minister called on the opposition and the Free Syrian Army to form a government of national unity. He also appealed to al-Assad to accept a safe exit that would help the Syrian president avoid prosecution.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 1 to 2 p.m. at 11760 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6060, 6050, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 6 p.m. to midnight at www.radiohc.cu and now podcasting at World Radio Network, which is wrn.org. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please support independently produced radio like listeners in Tahunga, California and Willits, California did this week. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. Some Arab nations say that they will submit to the United Nations a transition plan for democracy in Syria. Syria replied that neither Saudi Arabia nor Qatar is in a position to discuss democracy. A Japanese government panel has released their findings after investigating the Fukushima nuclear disaster, pointing out conflicts between the government and the plant operators, and the dangerous situation of earthquakes near nuclear power plants. NHK World Radio Japan.
Arab nations say they plan to submit to the UN General Assembly a draft resolution calling for a transition to a democratic government in Syria. Saudi Arabia's UN Ambassador Abdullah Mualimi and Qatari diplomat Abdulrahman Al-Hamadi announced the move at the UN Security Council on Wednesday. The move comes a week after Russia and China rejected a Security Council draft resolution that would have imposed a sanction on the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. Al-Hamadi said he regrets the Security Council's inability to effectively deal with the Syrian crisis. He said that Arab nations are going to the General Assembly to deal with the Syrian crisis. But Syria's UN Ambassador Bashar al-Jafari hit back, accusing Saudi Arabia and Qatar of interfering militarily, financially, and politically in Syria. He said that neither country is in a position to discuss democracy, as their actions reflect their interest in oil. Saudi Arabia and Qatar are reportedly providing arms to Syrian opposition groups.
A government panel investigating the nuclear accident at the Fukushima Daiichi plant says the operator of the plant lacked a sense of crisis and imagination for a possible tsunami. It says Tokyo Electric Power Company should realize that Japan is prone to natural disasters and changes attitude toward disaster preparedness. The panel of government-appointed experts submitted its final report on Monday. The report criticized the way the utility handled the accident at the Daiichi plant. It compared the Daiichi plant with another nearby plant, the Fukushima Daini plant, which avoided a nuclear accident, although its reactors were also hit by tsunami. It says workers at the Daini plant kept monitoring the pressure and temperature of the reactor containment vessels and prepared for alternative ways to inject water. The panel also examined whether it was appropriate for the Prime Minister at the time, Naoto Kan, to discuss with TEPCO officials whether to inject seawater into reactors to prevent them from reaching criticality again. It determined that the government should not have intervened in the matter before the power company had made a decision. The report also points out that TEPCO had urged a government task force on earthquake research to change its wording about a powerful earthquake that hit northeastern Japan 1,100 years ago. TEPCO said the report could be interpreted as meaning the area was regularly hit by strong earthquakes. The report says the utility's lack of a sense of crisis was one of the main reasons behind the accident. The panel is urging the government to continue its probe. It says the cause of the accident has not been fully disclosed. Apart from the government, private sector experts and the Diet have also released their own reports on the nuclear accidents.
The final report on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident by a panel of experts asks the government to continue investigating the causes of the accident. It also urges further study on the total amount of damage caused by the accident. Panel members were hampered during their year-long investigation with high levels of radiation at the plant. This issue prevented them from entering the four reactors. The report says that they were unable to learn why the number two reactor had discharged the largest amount of radioactive substances. They were also unable to determine why a hydrogen explosion had occurred at the number one reactor. The panel strongly urges the government and Tokyo Electric Power Company to continue with an on-site investigation after radioactive levels decrease. The report also discusses the large number of deaths caused by the stress of evacuation. A lack of medical assistance and care facilities was also a factor. It says the government must learn the reasons behind the deaths. The panel emphasizes that insights gained from the accident must be shared with the public as important lessons for the future. The report concludes that this is the government's responsibility.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 10 p.m. to 10:30 at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasts using a shortwave radio at home, which is far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is even easier there. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. This shortwave report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. This shortwave report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.